Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Max Moore. He's the president of Extropy Institute and the director of content solutions at Many Worlds. Welcome, Max.
Thank you, James.
Now, you started the Extropy Institute along with a group of other folks about 12 years ago now. How did that come about?
Well, it actually started with a magazine before the Institute, about 3 or 4 years before the Institute. And I founded that along with Tom Morrow, assumed name. And really the idea of the magazine on my side originally was that I'd always had a lot of odd ideas since I was in England, interested in things like life extension, space exploration, just living longer, getting smarter, all these things revolving around advanced technologies to improve the human condition. And nobody seemed to be wanting to write about every one of those. There were magazines on one type of freedom or getting smarter or life extension, but not putting them together into one whole. And to me, they seemed to have a connection which sort of inspired the word extropy, which is not a term that I invented. All of them have in common the idea of overcoming limits, whether it's the limits of the gravity well to get into space, the limits of human longevity, human intelligence, human emotional understanding, and so on. So the common idea was that just because things have been a certain way for a very long time, perhaps since we became human beings, is not a good reason to accept that they must always be that way. There'll be new, very powerful technologies coming along, and we need some kind of critical thinking, critical and creative thinking about the possibilities that opens up. And Extropy was really an attempt to bring people together, which it did very well, starting off very small and eventually led to the Institute so we could have conferences and other kinds of forums.
You mentioned that Tom Tio Morrow had an assumed name. You've also assumed a name. A number of other of Extropians have. What was the thinking behind taking on different names?
Well, for most people, I think it's just like on the Internet. A lot of people in the Internet culture have usernames which are different from their actual name. A way of assuming a personality for a certain purpose. And I think within Extropian circles, the idea is really, it's a way of choosing your identity. The whole part of the Extropian thing is you choose who you are. So it's very Nietzschean in that sense, too. You decide on yourself and then you become that self, which of course is not very easy yet. We don't have good technologies for that. It takes a lot of struggle. But my purpose in assuming my name, I kept my first name and changed my second one because my surname was Irish and I haven't even been to Ireland, don't have much association with Ireland. So it didn't seem particularly appropriate to me philosophically to keep a given name that didn't mean anything. But I wanted something that reminded me of an essential Extropian idea, which is always to become better, to become more than I am today. So I became Max Moore. Besides, I like the alliteration because all the superheroes have alliterative names. I've read a lot of superhero comics. That's probably a secret reason why it's alliterative. I was once asked when I was in the philosophy department at USC as a grad student there, one of the professors said, "Why not Max Most?" And I said, "That would be extremely arrogant, wouldn't it? I'd assume I'm the most that I can be." So that's how I came to that. It's really sort of just a label. A lot of cultures have done this, where you assume a new label to signify your values.
Mm-hmm. You came to the United States in the late 80s from Britain, and you've said things about the difference between British and American culture, that American culture is more dynamic and British culture has a heavier weight of history. Do you think that that's beginning to turn around? Is a new Europe beginning to emerge, or do you still feel that way?
Well, it has begun to change. I must say I feel a lot more friendly towards England than I did when I left it in 1987, partly by getting to know America better and seeing how many very conservative elements there are. And by conservative, I don't necessarily mean Republican. I mean really conservative in all senses, culturally conservative, economically conservative. England has become, especially England actually, more than the rest of continental Europe, has become more forward-thinking. Recently we've seen some excellent decisions, even in the crusty old House of Lords. They're actually coming out in defense of stem cell research, whereas here we're having a very hard time with that. And I think England is looking a lot more promising. If I had to move somewhere in the future, I wouldn't mind so much England. The rest of continental Europe is more varied. Generally, I think, is not so innovative, not so entrepreneurial in the thinking. But like England, I think, is less religious than America, which is generally a plus as far as I'm concerned.
Your dissertation was on the nature of the self, trying to pursue some of the questions about the continuity of the self and the identity of the self. Was that principally motivated by cryonics, this idea that we might be able to freeze people and then go in and reconstitute their brains from pre-existing patterns, and who would that person be later on?
Well, I'm not sure it was really motivated by cryonics, although that certainly fed into it because I certainly wanted to examine issues of suspension, you know, where are you when you're not functioning, if you're just frozen, is there a person there, what if you copy somebody and then maybe revive, you know, the duplicate rather than the original, or you scan someone's brain and transfer it, are you still there? So that certainly came in, was probably a motivation. But there are a lot of other issues which I covered there. I think that was one chapter I devoted to those kinds of issues of when is death, when do you really end. But most of it was actually concerned more with the dynamics of change in the self. I think like many other philosophers who've looked at identity in recent years, I saw that the more you look at it, the more it seems to dissolve. It's very hard to get a handle on identity. And I came to view it as being a very dynamic thing, not something static. And so I became very interested in how much change can you undergo if you take a psychoactive drug, for instance, a Prozac or an anti-anxiety drug. Who is the person after that, and how are they related to the person before? How responsible are they for the previous person's promises or abuses? There's a lot of issues that come up there, and we're seeing more and more of those as people take psychoactive chemicals, having various implants. And I think in the future, you know, moving towards designer personalities, it's, you know, raise issues that will be new to many people, but which Aristotle thought about over 2,000 years ago. And he did consider the question of, what if you commit a crime while you're inebriated? Are you responsible? Essentially, are you in the same mind? Those kinds of issues are coming out more and more, and we see it in the culture. It's interesting just to go to the movies. You see it in movies like Total Recall, where, you know, the main character played by Schwarzenegger isn't quite sure who he is. He has a personality overlay. You see it in Blade Runner and quite a few other movies. Imposter, I think, recently came out. So it's a very common theme, and I think there's a reason why that's the case. People are seeing their self as something that's more amenable to change. And, you know, as we transhumanists look further into the future, that becomes a more extreme possibility also.
What exactly is transhumanism, and how is it related to extropianism?
Well, you probably get somewhat different answers depending on who you ask. But in my view, transhumanism, when I wrote an essay on that back in 1990, I very much put it in the context of humanism. To me, it really is transhumanism. Now, there are some transhumanists, I think, out there who don't necessarily see much of a connection there. They may focus more on the trans than the humanism, and they think of it primarily as just becoming more than human. To me, it also involves the values of the Enlightenment, the humanist Enlightenment, that we're not just becoming more than we are in order to do something random like dominate other people or pave over the universe. We're doing it because we want to improve ourselves. We want moral improvement, social improvement. We want to have more possibilities to develop ourselves. So it includes the humanist ideals of reason as a means of learning the truth or getting closer to the truth rather than faith or dogma. It includes basic optimism, not a passive form, as in, you know, wishing for a god or a government or a group or whoever it is, your partner, to solve a problem. It involves being proactive, taking charge, using new technologies. So, you know, humanists agree with a lot of that, but they tend to draw the line at the human condition that we're going to improve, whereas transhumanists of all stripes essentially want to become more and better than human. And extropians, I think of extropian thinking as a particular perspective on that. It's not that extropianism and transhumanism are two different things. It's a particular perspective on transhumanism that emphasizes certain parts more than others, and is perhaps a little more specifically defined. So you can think of it as kind of a brand, if you like, to put it in commercial terms, sort of a brand of transhumanism that appeals to some people more than others.
I'm speaking with Max Moore. He's the president of Extropy Institute and director of content solutions at Many Worlds. Now, I and some others have described as a shorthand extropianism as libertarian transhumanism, and you've taken issue with that. Is it fair to say that extropianism in the early 90s was more libertarian and has emphasized more non-libertarian ideas or broadened its political perspective, or have you never considered yourself a libertarian?
No, I would say that your characterization was pretty accurate. It certainly was a lot more 10 years or so ago. I certainly thought of myself as a libertarian at that time. I don't really anymore. I think the people who call themselves extropians today are much more diverse. But I think also as the philosophy developed, it became clear to me that I think even the early versions of the principles, there was no necessary connection between the two, though it was more explicit. But as time has gone on, I've seen that what really matters is the underlying values, which in the current version of the principles emphasizes things like self-direction. You should be responsible for your own actions, that you should generally be allowed to take your own actions so long as you aren't harming others, which is certainly compatible with a libertarian view, but also with other kinds of political views, so long as they're not hostile to freedom. And the other principle that's relevant being open society, which obviously, again, relates to libertarianism, but also to many forms of democracy. So I don't think there's no absolute connection between the two. I think there's been a natural attraction to for libertarians to something like extropianism because it does emphasize freedom, not just politically and socially, but on every level, sort of philosophical level too. So there's sort of a natural connection, but it's not a necessary one. I think even most people who are not libertarians tend to be very libertarian in many ways. They tend to be very tolerant of people's differences in many ways. While they may not be the same on the economic level, they're pretty much the same on a cultural level. I think it's very interesting, James, for instance, that on many of the forums that we're both on, we see people coming on, for instance, who are transgender or maybe undecided gender. And when someone announces that and discusses it, instead of, you know, sort of awkward silences or painful comments from people, it's like the most natural thing. In fact, I think we probably had, on a recent poll early on, we had more transgender people than we had females, which was interesting for a while.
I saw that 10% of the extropians said that they were transgender.
I think that's probably distorted because it was probably, I think those people started first and then the numbers weren't, I haven't checked it recently, but I think that was certainly out of whack as representative. But it was an interesting sign that, you know, groups like that are very comfortable, as they should be, because if you're thinking about totally transforming the human condition, what does it matter that you're reassigning gender to suit yourself better? That seems like a trivial thing. So things like that, or being gay, or other things that have given many people pause, really are pretty trivial to transhumanists. I think that's a good thing.
What's the social life of the extropians around the country? I mean, you and your wife, Natasha Vidamore, are based in Los Angeles, and there are small groups of extropians around the country who meet, and then you have these extra conferences. But is that the sum total of it, a set of smattering of meetings and a conference?
It's very distributed. It's, you know, there are the online events. I think the online forums are the main area of socialization for most people. That's very intensive, and since the Internet's really got going, days of the web, we've seen extropian and other transhumanist ideas spreading very rapidly internationally. So I hear from all over the world now. Even though it's primarily concentrated in America, North America, it is pretty much global now. For people here, I think it's a lot of it's online, a lot of online socialization, especially for people stuck in places like Oklahoma. I've known people in reason-forsaken states like that where the only way they can talk to anybody on the same level is really by the Internet. But in other places like Los Angeles, Northern California, Boston area, New York, and a number of other states, there are growing numbers of groups getting together. I think Arizona is one of the most recent ones. But people meet regularly, either for dinner or for debates or discussions. It takes different forms depending on people's personalities. And then, as you mentioned, the conferences, we've had five big conferences so far. Those tend to be a very unique kind of energizing event, different from all the others. And there's a lot of informal stuff going on, informal networking off to the side. So that's the main thing. We don't have too many highly organized events, I think, because extropians and other transhumanists aren't the kinds who like to be too highly organized by anybody.
You also have a board now for the Extropy Institute, some fairly well-known computer scientists, Ray Kurzweil, Marvin Minsky, people like that. What's the purpose of the broader organization of the Extropy Institute? Do you have an agenda in terms of more publications, more organizing, more chapters?
Well, there's a lot of central plans limited only by really by input of energy and finance. We've always been very limited because we've done things backward. Most organizations, take a random example, the Electronic Frontier Foundation was founded by, was it five or six multimillionaires, so it's well endowed, whereas we started off as two graduate students and tried to work up from there. So I don't recommend that practice particularly to other people. But what we've tried to do with our limited resources is essentially two main things. We've tried to, first of all, act as a brainstorming forum, in which we bring together people from many different fields, and that includes, as you mentioned, that the Council of Advisors from many fields, and we're trying to expand that, to mix ideas together so we get a very cross-disciplinary view of the possibilities of the future. Rather than just being a computer scientist view or roboticist or philosophers, we bring lots of different disciplines together and get a much more rounded view. Because I think, and you probably agree with me, James, that a lot of projections of the future are quite laughable when you look at them. They're made by somebody in one discipline, and they tend to project their own discipline as the main force. Ignore many of the factors, with the result that most predictions are hopelessly far off. So we're hoping to get a slightly better idea by mixing together perspectives. Then the second purpose is really to spread those ideas to the public and to encourage debate. And I think over the last couple of years, we focus more and more on trying to actually stir up some debate, because we've now passed the point where we have to convince people that things like tissue regeneration are possible or life extension is possible. That's all over the place in the culture now, in the magazines and books. So now really the issue is serious discussion of the consequences and how do we prepare more effectively. So I see that as Extropy Institute's main role today and my own personal mission, too.
The Foresight Institute has issued a number of policy papers about how to regulate nanotechnology. Do you see the Extropy Institute as also having a kind of policy goal, and how does that fit also with the project, the PROACT, Progress Action Coalition, that Natasha is heading up?
Well, that's an important area, I think, to get into policy issues. That's something we're focusing on more and more, and we've been doing press releases on some of the recent issues, such as Bush's views on stem cells, or rather the Council of Advisors he's put together to issue statements on that. So we would like to build up more groups of experts to make comments on these technologies and these policies as they are now actually being considered for real rather than as some far-off speculation. And PROACT, as you mentioned, is an initiative which we started a while ago, and we're hoping to give another boost very soon. And the goal of that really is to focus specifically on current issues, things that are out there right now, and what can we do, how can we influence thinking about these. Because, as I found from the days when I was teaching, most students, therefore most of the population, are horribly ignorant of most of these technologies. They've got a very vague idea of what they mean, and usually ignorance leads to fear when we're talking about big changes. So I think it's the goal really to try to educate, which combines with our larger mission, and to explore the particular issues and show some new possibilities. But it's not either, for instance, you're not either fully in favor of all and any human cloning, or you're totally against it all. There are all kinds of other middle grounds.
You recently had an extended discussion with Ray Kurzweil in his KurzweilAI.net space about the nature of the singularity. What is the singularity? And then let's get into a little bit about the different visions of it. But first, what's the singularity?
The singularity is an idea, essentially taking the idea from mathematics of a mathematical singularity, which is a function that's exponentially growing until, if you plot it on a graph, it's going along almost horizontally, it's turning up, it's becoming more and more vertical, and essentially becomes infinite. So you have an infinite amount of change within a finite period of time. And I don't think many people are saying that's going to be literally true, but there are many people who believe that technological advance is accelerating. And even, I think, as Ray Kurzweil has shown pretty well, at least in the area of computers and information technology, the rate of acceleration is itself accelerating. So, for instance, we had Moore's Law, which originally was, say, 2 years. Every 2 years, computer power would double for the same price. Now it's like 18 months. Moravec is arguing it's maybe a year. So the doubling time is itself accelerating. And if the idea is if you project that out, then in not very many years from now, 2 or 3 decades from now, you see some pretty incredible rates of change where essentially machines become more intelligent than human beings, where all kinds of capabilities are much larger than we have now. And it's like a time compression. If you took the years between, say, 1640 and 1700, you'd probably see rather little change. Whereas if you took the last past few decades, you see a huge amount of change. And in the future, even more so. So it's so dramatic. One conception of the singularity being you cannot really understand the future. It's like a wall that prevents you seeing what's beyond that. Not because anything mystical is happening, but because it's so radically changed. In the discussion with Ray, my concern was, as it has been with the singularity concept, that there's a bit too much of a technologist's projection going on here. But yes, sure, it may be true that information technology is accelerating faster and faster. It doesn't imply that the results of those technologies will necessarily rush out at the same rate. And they give some examples of business software, for instance, where stuff has been around for years, but nobody knows quite how to adapt to it, how to change their culture, their priorities, their processes, and it lags behind. And that actually explains a lot of why we didn't see an acceleration in productivity for quite a while with computers until fairly recently. People figured out how to actually use them more effectively. It was the same with steam power and all the other new technologies. At first, it didn't really help productivity. You had to get used to it. So that's my contention. I think the singularity view is reasonably accurate, but I think it's going to be stretched out a little bit more than that for economic reasons, cultural, psychological reasons. But and it won't seem like a singularity when we're there, because there isn't really a there to get to. It will just be like more change ahead of us, and that will keep receding, obviously, as more possibilities come out. And we'll probably get used to it as we speed up ourselves.
I'm quite sympathetic to that muddling through view. And one of the reasons is because I see a lot of the singularity discussion as influenced, unacknowledged, by the history of apocalyptic thinking and a kind of apocalyptic sentiment on part of people's part that the world's a screwed up place and we look forward to a dramatic cleansing, a dramatic change. Do you think that that's an influence, one of the kind of unacknowledged influences in the movement?
Oh, yes, very much so. I completely agree with that. In fact, I've referred to it as, I think Tim May originally referred to this as the rapture of the future. I think I probably borrowed that from him. It's very much that idea that in the Christian eschatology, the rapture will come and everybody will be taken up and the world will be transformed. And at least for some singularity advocates, there's a whole range of them and all kinds of different levels, but for some, I think there is that very strong temptation. It's a very powerful cultural idea, this idea of effortless change, which you don't really have to do much for it to happen, that in this case, the machines will take over and make things better for us, and they'll be benevolent. I find that kind of a frightening idea because it takes away from the idea of personal responsibility, the idea we can influence the future, and that we really need to have responsibility to do that. So the idea that we can sit back and let a benign AI just come about somehow and then improve everything, to me, is certainly the opposite of extropian ideas of self-direction and personal responsibility.
I'm speaking with Max Moore. He's the president of Extropy Institute, a leading futurist philosopher and the director of content solutions at Many Worlds. One of the accusations that's made against transhumanism as a whole, and extropianism in particular, is that it is blindly techno-optimistic, ignores the potential downsides. You mentioned earlier that one of the goals that you saw of Extropy Institute is to think about the consequences of technology. Do you think that in the same light as some folks in this milieu have a kind of apocalyptic or techno-rapture idea, that some also have a weakness for the optimism as opposed to the critical thinking about the potential downsides of technology?
Well, there's a whole range of different approaches among the people I've seen, but I think certainly, again, some people do approach it that way. And, you know, I have a confession to make. I think that I approached it largely that way, you know, a decade or so ago. I pretty much exclusively focused on the positive possibilities. And I think one reason for that for me personally was it was a reaction against all the negativity around me. I grew up at a time, you know, in the 70s in England that were pretty negative and pessimistic and apocalyptic, everybody expecting to get nuked to death at any moment. And, when I was at Oxford University, everybody was dressed in dark drab covers, colors, always protesting about everything, never talking about anything positive. So I think to me it was kind of a reaction to say, hey, things aren't that bad and here are ways we can make them better. But now that many more people are recognizing these possibilities, I feel more comfortable sort of stepping back a little bit and saying, okay, there are some real concerns we have to deal with too. Because if you don't do that, then you know, the fearmongers who are out there, and there are many of them, will just magnify the problems and distort them. And if on the other side you're just saying everything's fine and just being Panglossian about it, they won't take you seriously. Unfortunately, they still take the doomsayers seriously because people love to be frightened. It seems to be a basic human desire. But if you obviously intelligently address the issues, you acknowledge the real ones and you look at them critically, I think that'll be a lot more effective in the long run in getting people to understand the more positive sides.
There was a techno-realist manifesto published a couple of years ago, mostly by people concerned about computer technology, and they were trying to be a middle point between techno-Luddites or anti-computer, anti-net people, and the techno-optimists, the Toffler and other kinds of people. Do you think that that's the kind of position that you're moving towards, and more of trying to be have as much critical thinking about consequences of technology as possible?
Yes, I'm not familiar with that particular group and what they've said, but yes, that's really the idea. I think, you know, fundamentally, technology is the answer. I'm not ashamed to say that because technology is simply an extension of the human will. And if we have a good will, if we desire to improve ourselves, to improve the world, as I think many people do, and just do it in many wrong ways often because of, you know, lack of knowledge or because of other desires, but I think fundamentally technology expresses the human desire to change the world and change ourselves for the better. So it fundamentally, I think, is in a way it is value neutral, but it's also almost inherently does go about improving the world unless it's perverted in some way, as I would say, according to my value system. So yes, we have to be very careful because these new technologies are incredibly powerful. We've seen that humans can do some just awful, dreadful things. We look back just in the last century with Stalin and Hitler and many other examples. Humans can do horrific things, and so it's very important that we distribute power. I don't want to see centralized power. We have to deal with some very difficult issues globally now as to how do we control weapons of mass destruction without allowing one authority to get them all and then possibly become turn itself at some point, as we've seen happen before. So there are some pretty frightening things. You know, what if terrorists could actually design very effective targeted biological weapons? And for me, also is another reason why I don't call myself a libertarian anymore, is because I don't want to rule out in principle the idea that we have to have some kind of enforcement of laws which may restrict freedom to some degree in order to enhance security for everybody. I certainly want to minimize that kind of centralized control and distribute it as much as possible. But if we need it, then we need it. And I think, you know, abstract principle shouldn't stand in the way of that. When the motivation for those principles no longer really holds.
Well, that's very interesting for me to hear because, as you know, I've been polemicizing as a democratic transhumanist for some time, arguing for the legitimacy of democratic policy approaches. One of the questions that's been particularly sticking in my craw about the development of a transhuman society is the need to hold together a solidarity between humans 0.1 or even 1.0 or 0.8 or something like that, and humans who have taken some kind of transhuman transition and become more than human, post-humans. What do you see as the prospects of pulling together, holding together a polity that includes both of those kinds of beings?
Well, that's a tough question because I really can't pretend that I can see what's going to happen there. I do think it's a very important issue we have to really focus on, and there's been very little creative thinking about those possibilities. There's been a few people who've looked at some new possibilities. For instance, Bart Kosko, with his fuzzy logic background, has tried to propose some new possibilities for politics, new political systems. Most people are very uncreative. They just have a basic democratic position right now. In fact, we don't really have exactly a democracy in this country, but that's what it's usually called. But there are hardly any discussion of innovative systems. How do we get social decisions to reflect more accurately individual decisions? How do we allow people to express their preferences without harming other people? Now, the founder of this country actually spent a lot of time thinking about those issues, and it worked reasonably well, with many exceptions from slavery onwards. But it's done a fairly good job if you look at it in the historical context, but it's now breaking down. People have found ways around those rules, constitutional rules, and whole new issues have arisen that haven't been discussed. For instance, I think there should really be a constitutional right to alter your brain and body in ways that don't obviously cause an inherent harm to anybody else. And yet that kind of principle is not being recognized. It is a frightening prospect. I mean, one great fictionalization of possible future prospect was by the science fiction writer Nancy Kress in Beggars in Spain, which I thought was a really wonderful, just picking on a few changes. She imagined that there were new people born through genetic engineering who didn't need to sleep. And they had a couple of rather nice side effects, and I always envied the characters. Not only did they not need to sleep, they were inherently happy and well-motivated, so they didn't just sit around. They basically were being productive all the time. And then a further side effect turned out later on that they lived very much longer than human beings. Of course, everybody hated them and became very resentful. And they had to deal with the issue, do we stay within the society and try to change it, or do we retreat? And they decided to retreat. To me, the goal is to try and spread these technologies as quickly as possible, partly by getting people to accept them and partly by finding ways to reduce the prices as quickly as possible if they tend to be expensive. We won't really know that just yet. The more people who see these things as something they can have, the less I think people will want to attack those who do have them.
You have recently become director of content solutions at Many Worlds. I guess when did that happen, and what is Many Worlds?
Well, I've been looking at Many Worlds for 3 years now, I think, starting part-time, and been full-time about 2 years since I stopped teaching. Many Worlds does a number of things. It's, I guess, a basis you could call it, to use now slightly stale terminology, a new economy business consulting company. We actually produce a knowledge management solution, and I feed a lot of information into that so businesses can find a lot of useful information on leadership, innovation, dealing with new technologies, and planning for the future. My particular angle, of course, is future planning. How can you systematically plan for the future as a business to prepare yourself for shocking changes? Most people aren't really well equipped to do that. So that's a lot of what we do. We also do planning some seminars on strategy and future planning and help people overcome their business problems. So I sort of came in as a corporate philosopher, if you like. The first thing I do, and one of my main responsibilities still, is to design the way our topics relate. We have a lot of different topics in business, several dozen of them. And I have to sort of carve up the whole knowledge space into sensible areas that people will be interested in and relate those. And I spend a lot of time every day essentially scanning through numerous publications, finding the best stuff, reviewing it, putting it into our database. And it's also very good research for myself.
That's manyworlds.com?
Yes. It's a company based in Houston, Texas.
And you can be found at maxmoore.com.
That's right.
And Extropy can be found at extropy.org.
That's correct. And if anybody wants to visit my site to look at my writings, I have to warn them that the site's rather out of date. It needs a bit of an update, so some of the more recent stuff isn't on there. But there's a lot of material, including the entire text of my PhD dissertation, if anybody's motivated enough to read that.
I did.
Okay.
I found it quite fascinating. I've been speaking with Max Moore. He's president of Extropy Institute, one of the leading futurist philosophers in our milieu, and director of content solutions at Many Worlds. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, James. Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.